Welcome back to the Movies on the Brain podcast. We still exist. I am one of your hosts, Brian C. Wood. With me tonight is my co-host, as always,
Chad Metz.
Welcome to another weird, wild, and wacky week in the world of genre movie news. And boy, do we have some actual genre news for you. Movie news is aplentiful. So on this week's episode, we're going to cover a lot of topics. But first, I want to begin, Chad, with the most important bit of movie news to come out in the last week. What are your thoughts on the fact that Pepper Potts may be pregnant with Tony Stark's baby?
See, this is, again, why we need video. So people can see my face when you drop this on me. Because I had no idea this was coming. And one, I mean, they heavily alluded to it in this last movie. So I would not be surprised. Two, and the answer that matters the most, I don't care. I don't care. I don't care. I don't care.
So I'm excited about this prospect because it means that there is a life for her beyond what she's already done. And they get to go be happy parents.
Are they going to be happy parents? Or is she going to be a parent? And I don't know about anything about duo and happy in there.
Well, I mean, there is a happy Hogan. I mean, I think it's, people are trying to figure out any kind of piece they can to figure out what's going to happen to the original six. And if, you know, Pepper Potts is out, if Paltrow's out there saying that, start babies.
She's the one who said this?
Mm-hmm.
Why is she stirring the pot?
In an official Avengers interview, so.
That makes me want to believe that it won't happen. Because, I mean, again, the cast themselves joke about Marvel snipers, and they will take them out when they say stuff. So she's just going to willy-nilly say, yeah, Stark babies, and not get popped. Nah. So I think this is a misdirect because they so heavily laid it on, and it doesn't turn out to be so, I guess. I don't know.
All right. So, Chad, there's a Star Wars movie out. We've both seen Solo now. I've seen it twice. What are our thoughts on Solo, a Star Wars story?
I think it was fine. Probably a little bit better than fine. I think it was good. It was fun. The cardinal sin for this movie is going to be its original sin, is that was the movie really needed? The answer is probably no, but it's here. So the question is it enjoyable? Not. I think it's enjoyable. But if you can't get past that original sin, well, this is just not going to be for you.
So what was your good about the film?
You know what? I really like Alden Ehrenreich. I know I haven't heard, like, really, really bad things about him, but he's always, like, further down on the list when people talk about what they like about the movie. I really enjoy him. He was not the Han Solo that we know, but kind of getting there. I thought he did well for what he was given. And I don't think what he was given was bad, but again, the original sin of this is just really necessary. So in that context, I think he did really good. I went in there expecting to be like, to cringe through it for a point and then just adapt to it and be like, it's fine. But I went there like, you know, I enjoy what he's doing with Han Solo. So him to a lesser extent, but I had no problem with almost any of the performances. Those were all pretty good. And given the way that this movie came to be between, you know, the director's problems to get like almost a straight line of performances to praise is miraculous in itself.
My good would be Chewbacca. I think Chewbacca gets an actual arc here and Kim's character shading and development and isn't just a walking carpet that is there to make jokes about porks. I think it's the new Jonas, the new guy who plays him, imbues him with a real sense of character in this movie, and his arc really helps, and the character design for him and his fellow Wookiees is also something that I enjoy. The detail that they give about, you know, about his home planet and about the Empire enslaving Wookiees after the battle in Revenge of the Sith, because we go to that planet, yeah. And with in Revenge of the Sith, I thought was a neat bit of canon. And I like the fact that he makes the choice to leave and go take care of his people, and then his people come back and help at the end. Help them escape, which I think it was a very nice touch. What was your not so good?
Not so good. I know everybody, I've heard talk about it, they really enjoy the Kessel Run. I guess just because I've heard about it so much, it was not what I envisioned it to be. So there was no way it was going to live up to that.
You mean you didn't know that it was parsecs were measures of distance, not time?
Yes, I did know that. I know Star Wars messed it up. And again, if you get past that, you just kind of got to go with it. But, you know, the way Han has always talked about the Kessel Run is always like, it was this miraculous feat that he accomplished, all him, and just him. And
his skill.
Yeah, and his skill. And it was a team effort. And I can see where the Han that we know would kind of gloss over that and stuff, but it was not what I expected, so therefore I was let down by it.
My not so good would be the score here. There's not a piece of music, and this is very weird for a Star Wars movie, there is not a piece of music that jumps out at me and it's just grabs me and makes me, you know, memorable. The love theme that they have between, you know, her and him is kind of got some echoes of him and Leia's, but like, there's not a piece of music that I come out of this movie going, oh yeah, I need that soundtrack. I need to hum that over and over and over again and have it stuck in my head. There wasn't any one piece of music. And to be quite honest, there was not one shot that really sticks in my mind.
I would agree with that. Cause as you said that, I'm like, there seems to be like one piece of music that like struck a chord with me, but I can't tell you when, where, or how it sounds, so that just kind of goes to your point. There is nothing memorable about the score. And as with the shot selection, I think it just feeds into the whole overall feeling of this movie just fine. There's nothing that, most of it's not going to stand out, but most of it's like well enough, and the story is well enough to go along that it's just fine to good. That's it.
Yeah. And, you know, I like the acting choices. Obviously, Lando's a hit. I like the twists, the twist reveal of what appears to be the antagonist for the majority of the picture just being a kid, and, like, them not understanding that, no, we're not pirates, we're not mercenaries, we're, you know, rebels. And the way that character correlates to Rebels, Star Wars Rebels, and the way that, you know, her mother and all that really worked for me. And I thought that was an interesting take because, you know, you have this perception in your mind and it changes that train sequence. It changes the way that you view that train sequence because it, you know, flips it on its head, really, because it's like these two sides should be working together, not, you know, fighting each other and causing, you know, the merchandise to be destroyed. That's pretty much my thought there. I'm thrilled to death we got, spoiler alert, I'm thrilled to death we got Darth Maul. All these little whiny babies, which we'll talk about in a little while, have been begging for Darth Maul to be returned to canon on the screen because he's been in Clone Wars and he's been in Rebels. Mm-hmm. And one could argue between Rebels and Clone Wars, he has an entire arc. Even just within Rebels, he has an entire arc that is satisfactory to Ray Park fans and to Star Wars fans in general. I'm sad that we're in the financial place that we are with this film, because I really think there are pieces here that a better director and, you know, more talented writer, so to speak, could take and really make interesting and dynamic and could help us get to that journey along of where Han needs to be at the end. But, like, the fact that we get finally get Darth Maul, the best part, one of the best parts of the prequels, back in canon, causing, you know, everybody's grandma to go, I thought he got chopped in half 17 years ago. Well, you see, there's these things that you need to know, because, like, there are TV shows that have shown that he was back alive, and, like, he had a robotic half-body, and he tried to go kill Palpatine, and then ultimately started working for Palpatine again, and, you know, tried to hunt down Obi-Wan, because he was ticked at Obi-Wan for cutting him in half, and then they fought again, and, you know, Obi-Wan got the better of him, yada, yada. Mm-hmm. Like, I love that you have to have those conversations walking out of the film. The same way I love the fact that when Nick Fury gets that sends that page out at the end of Infinity War, it's like, who's that? Oh, well, that's Captain Marvel. That's coming in 2019. So I'm sad that we're in the financial place that we are with this movie, because I was really looking forward to getting more of Kira and Darth Maul and that whole dynamic.
I don't think you can close the book on Darth Maul yet. Kira maybe, because I think she'd only show up if they did more solo stories. Darth Maul, I don't think this takes off the table.
To me, I mean, where are you going to put a... depends on where Mangold's going to set his Boba Fett movie. Because if he's setting his Boba Fett movie in between 4 and 5, for example, you can't have Darth Maul, because Darth Maul's already been killed a second time before A New Hope even starts.
So. No, but if you say Darth Maul, and...
Maul now.
What I'm about to say is going to be tricky because of what happens in Rebels, which I haven't seen, but I know what happens. So, spoiler alert for Rebels, you know, Darth Maul and Obi-Wan fight again, and he meets his end, finally, in Rebels. But
a determinable end, like a clear, definitive end.
Yeah.
There is no falling into a pit this time.
Yeah, so anything you do with Maul on the screen has to be between Rebels and this point we see him in. And if you say Maul, much like with Rebels, you want to see Obi-Wan and Maul. And Obi-Wan has been floated around. I don't think the reception to Solo will change Obi-Wan, because he has been...
I think that's one everybody wants.
Yes.
I think if they'd have come out at Star Wars Celebration 2015 and said, we're going to do an Obi-Wan movie in 2018, people would have been bouncing all over themselves.
Yep.
I think Solo had more of the tinge of... I don't need that. Thank you.
Yeah. And I hope that's the lesson that Disney learns from it, is that, you know, you have all this stuff to mind, but you don't have... There are certain things people don't want to see. Obi-Wan and Maul is one of them. Han Solo, not so much. Even though you get set up a Han Solo that I think people eventually come to embrace, or at least accept. And Orlando that people would really embrace. But I think the box office of this one is probably going to temper any movement on those fronts. But I don't think it's not going to stop Boba Fett. It's probably not going to stop Obi-Wan. It may space it out between the time they announce it and the time we get it. But I don't think it's stopped either one.
Well, I mean, they are going to be in Chicago next April.
Yeah, that's right.
So we will be getting announcements, because at that time we are going to be ending... We're going to be at the midway point of the marketing cycle for Episode 9. And we'll also have... There's nothing else on the books right now. I mean, yeah. Mangold's thing was announced a couple weeks ago, but there wasn't a date attached to it at all. The Obi-Wan thing's been floated around, and there are those rumors that, you know, people who are working at Pinewood now on 9 have been asked to sign new contracts to come back and start production work on Obi-Wan after 9 wraps filming, which would be sometime around the fall. So there are those rumors as well. But again, they're just rumors. Mm-hmm. There's the only thing Star Wars left on the calendar is December 2019. So it'll be interesting to see at Celebration, which is where you would think you would get the majority of these announcements, what gets announced. Because, I mean, so what was your bet for Solo? Besides the fan reaction.
I mean, I don't really have bad, just because I just think this is just a fine movie. Most of the bad comes in with the the Numbnuts fans and their reaction. I'm sure you'll say something and I'll probably agree with it, but I can't think of anything that I would classify as like terrible besides the people that are supposed to enjoy these films.
Okay, so I love Paul Bettany. Good dude. Fine dude. Came in at the end to save people's rear ends. Not great. I mean, he's hamming it up, but he's not Cate Blanchett hamming it up. So, like, Cate Blanchett looks like she's having fun and she's enjoying herself, but she also, like, lends credibility to the role. This guy, Bettany just kind of looks like he's going through the motion and, like, I'm going to be a theatrical evil bad guy. And I'm really going to tell you how it could have been and how it should be. You know, that kind of a thing. And, you know, so that would be one of my bad. The other bad would be L3. I love her L3. I love the character. I like the kind of K2SO-ness of her. Creeped out by the fact that her and Lando were making it work. But that adds a different layer to what happens at the end of the film, where, again, spoilers, you know, the reason C-3PO doesn't detect the ship having a very weird dialect is because the ship is L3. Her navigational system, her brain, was implanted into the Falcon. Which, you know, Lando then promptly lost.
Yeah.
So therefore, he lost his lover. The last vestige of his lover is gone.
So apparently, in Star Wars lore, there's three droids that make up the Falcon's computer brain. So she is just one of them. I don't know if the other two are in there or what, but that's been like, that's actually part of canon. But yeah, because of what happened with L3 in this movie, it does kind of complicate the things about Han and Lando and the Falcon, particularly that. One, Han, it's alluded to that Han, well, it's not alluded to, but Han would know how Lando felt about the droid. Han knows that the droid is implanted into the Falcon. Han doesn't give a shit that the droid is implanted into the Falcon and takes it from Lando anyway. Then there's Lando, who clearly, whatever with the droid, is so distraught by it, he just leaves them and takes the ship and just leaves them. Yet, the next time you see Han, he just puts the Falcon up puts the Falcon up, knowing that that's his last vestige to the droid. It also begs questions like when, you can't retcon these old movies, but you would think that it would be a little bit more emotional when Lando sees the Falcon, and in particular when Lando's flying the Falcon in Return of the Jedi. But, you know, that's what happens when you make...
I think he does have that line, hello, old girl, or whatever it is.
Okay, see, that makes me feel a little bit better. Yeah. I haven't seen Return of the Jedi in a while.
But, I mean, the bigger issue for me is that a droid was running around taking restraining bolts off and imploring robot freedom, and then...
Yes.
And then becomes enslaved for the rest of eternity.
That is also a problem with the whole L3 thing. I don't know if it was written that way or that's part of like the ad libs. They got the other dudes fired and it just made it into Ron Howard's cut and now it's canon. I don't know. A lot of these things we'll never know with this movie until, you know, they release the documentary about it.
Or somebody writes the book.
Yeah. So, yeah, there are a lot of complications with L3. And you just can't get away from that.
Yeah, that would be my bad. Other than that, man, like, it's a good movie. It's a fun time at the movies. It's not, like, horrible, but, you know, I feel a lot about the same way I felt about the prequels. In the prequels, as I've preached on this podcast many times, I saw what George was trying to do. George was trying to tell a Shakespearean tragedy, and he just wasn't executing it very well. He had the theme, broad themes, he had the ideas of tragedy, of heartache, of loss, of grief, and how one deals with those things, and how they can, you know, rack your soul if you're not careful, if you don't recover from them the right way. He had those ideas and those themes, but he didn't execute them very well. Because of somewhere along the way, he lost his touch with actors, like getting good performances from legit actors. Now, part of that might have been because he didn't direct a whole lot after the original trilogy. Mm-hmm. And acting dynamics changed, over time. But I saw what he was trying to do. And in this, I see what Lucasfilm, and I guess you have to say the cast in Father and Son, and mm-hmm. Kathleen Kennedy, I see what they wanted to do. I think that what they wanted to do was, over the course of three films, tell a story of a wide-eyed, bushy-tailed, optimistic, lovesick guy who slowly but surely became more jaded as more people screwed him over. Lando screwing him over, Woody Harrelson's character screwing him over, that he gets closer and closer to the guy we know in A New Hope, but that ultimately the revelation of who and what his long-lost lover had become, and the fact that she would ultimately betray him in what I would assume would be some kind of deeply personal manner and a deeply personal moment, would jade him to the idea of love at all, and would jade him to giving a crap about anybody. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where they're going. They have the line very specifically in The Falcon where Kira goes, looks at him and goes very simply, "If you knew what I've done, you wouldn't look at me the way that you look at me right now." And Kira makes the choice when Beckett dies to pick up the ring and go get in touch with Maul and to continue in that life even after Han is back into her life. Because she can't see herself as... She doesn't see herself as redeemable. She can't see past her own sins to see the good in her, as, Padme Amidala would say, or Luke Skywalker would say. So... I get what they're... I can see the broad outlines of what they're trying to do and how they're trying to arc, his solo into Han, into who Harrison Ford's solo is. I see the broad strokes of what they wanted to do. Their execution isn't great. It's haphazard, and some of that is because you didn't have a straight director. Say what you want to about Ant-Man and how okay it is and how fun it is and whatever. Peyton Reed took that movie over a month before shooting. They fired Edgar in April. They were going to start rolling film in July. They hired Peyton in May. Mm-hmm. He had like 6 to 8 weeks on that film. Now he had a lot of help because Marvel was, already had the ideas of what they really wanted out of that film. And they do a good enough job that you can't really tell what's Edgar's and what's Peyton's. But they execute that the story that they want to execute, and they do it in a fun, interesting way that still stands out in the MCU, while not being as tonally different as what Edgar probably would have done. You know, like, he got 6 to 8 weeks to help, Rudd and McKay wrote the script. He was working with them hand in hand. They were writing as they were going. They did all of it, but they had some prep time before they started shooting. They asked Howard to basically reshoot the whole movie mm-hmm. in 4 months with no prep time and a couple of sound stages at Pinewood, getting actors back as you could. There's no way that was going to be a coherent film. There was no way that was going to be a great cinematic achievement yeah. worthy of the kind of story that you're trying to tell. You can't execute tragic, faded love, I cannot see past my sins, I'm a wretched, horrible human being, And you can't reconcile that with the kind of, like... See what I'm saying? You can't do great tragedy, a great tragic love story over the course of a trilogy if in the first film you botch it.
Yeah.
And therein lies the problem. Kathleen Kennedy pulled the trigger on the firing last June because she felt she needed to. We will one day, when we're old and gray and she's retired, probably find out what those reasons were. I've read people talking about how Kathleen Kennedy saved this movie. I don't know what she saved it from. Because if we assume that the story basics are cast in script, and the only things that we've actually heard about Lord Miller's tenure on the film were that they were indecisive, meaning they weren't making... It was a Josh Trank situation where like they need decisions made about costumes or about set prep or about set decoration, and they were dragging their feet on them. And we've heard that they were heavily improvising. They were heavily asking Emmerich to improvise. They were getting the actors to be kind of improvisational and not adhering to every beat that was in the script. And that ticked Kasdan off. This film honestly could have used some more improvisation. Probably would have livened the film up. Probably would have made the film flow a little bit better. And it would have been probably infused it with even more fun than what's already there. And, you know, if you want to keep using the rhetoric that Kathleen Kennedy and Lawrence Kasdan, saved Solo from what it could have, the mess it would have been under Lord Miller, I don't see how that's possible. Because what you got was the most okay Star Wars movie you could ever have. Like, there's no way you could have had a bad Star Wars movie with those two.
You might have got a bad one. I think the gamble is you go from, you know, decent, fine, to this is just really bad.
But how? How can you make that determination based on their track record? Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs should not work. The Lego Movie should not work. The Jump Street Movie should not work. And guess what, Chad? A Solo movie should not work. A Han Solo origin movie should not work on any fundamental level, because it's just a bad idea on principle. Because you are demystifying one of the great figures in sci-fi history. And you, part of the excitement around that project was hiring the guys who took bad ideas and turned them into mega hits.
But with the exception of Jump Street, I mean, you're dealing with animation, right, which
takes about 4 years anyway.
Yeah, so you're kind of structured in that way that there, you can do what you want, but you can't like do what you want on the spot. That's not how animation works. It takes forever to do it. So that, I think that kind of constraint hones in their like sporadic nature with the improvisation. The 21 Jump Street movies, those movies are built to just be like wacky, all over the place kind of thing. So the improvisation will work for that. The question is out, like, what improvisation like that in that style work for a Star Wars movie? I think, knowing what we know about them, I would think that it wouldn't. I think it would be so jarring to Star Wars fans that they would revolt on it. Now, the flip side is, the Star Wars fans revolted on this movie. So, it's probably going to be, you're looking at the same kind of thing. But it could be like, the Star Wars fans revolt on it, but everybody else is like, this is a good movie, I don't know what they're tripping on. Or you go with that and the Star Wars fans revolt on it, and then the regular audience is like, I don't know what this is either. This is not Star Wars. This is just all over the place. And I think that's the gamble that Kathleen Kennedy and Lucasfilm had to make. And they were like, we're going to take the former. And I don't think they thought that Star Wars fans would revolt fully. But we're going to take the former. We'll make a decent movie. People will enjoy it. It'll make enough money, and we can get out of here without what could be on the other side of door number two.
I don't think Star Wars fans revolted. The conversations that are being had and the toxic fandom that is cropping up its ugly head is not in regards to Solo at all. Like, Star Wars fans stopped having conversations about Solo about a week after the movie came out. They just were done with it. It came out, they saw it, paid money to see it once, they didn't go back and see it again. And the conversations they're having are still about Last Jedi. I think what happened here was very, 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 very simple. Avengers Infinity War is still making $10 million over the weekend, and Deadpool 2 is still making massive amounts of money. And you got The Incredibles coming this week, and you've got Jurassic World coming the next week. And guess what? The summer movie season isn't what it was back in 2005, 2002, 1999, 1985, 1983, 1977. The summer movie season is completely different now. You've got studios staking out territory in March because they're trying to get enough breathing room for their mega franchises to make the money that it needs. Avengers moves up 2 weeks and completely changes the whole dynamic of the summer movie season and quite possibly the box office finances for the entire year. Like, this was a problem. You were 5 months out from your last Star Wars movie, which was, whatever, and we'll talk about that in a moment, but you're 5 months out. You saw how well Rogue One did in December. You make the deal. And you ask Mary, you shift Mary Poppins to Thanksgiving. And you put your movie there at Christmas. And you market the hell out of it. Because that was another problem with this film. The sketchiness of the marketing materials, not putting out a trailer until the Super Bowl, right around February, for a May release. And then also, like, the publicity for it being kind of truncated because of Infinity War, which the Disney marketing machine needed to get behind. I don't think this is about fans revolting, because I really don't think the film was good enough for fans to care. I don't think they cared about the film. It's the least, quote-unquote, social justice warrior of all the three. It's the most fan servicey of all the Disney movies that they've put out there. Because, like it or not, outside of the Vader cameo and Akbar, Rogue One is not very fanservice-y.
No.
So, this is the most fanservice of them all. You've got Lando, you've got the Falcon, you've got Chewie, you've got the dice, you've got, all of those unanswered questions that you never knew you wanted to ask. Like, this is the most fanservice-y of them all and the least... it's the one with a leading man, not a leading woman. The woman plays the love interest. I mean, everything is stereotypical Star Wars from what you need. So it's not like the film was okay. They didn't care. They moved on. They didn't go back and see it 2, 3, and 4 times. And to be quite honest, I don't know that they would have because of everything that's crowded around it. So I think this is a product of not fans rejecting the movie. I think it's a response to the date, and I think it's a response to the date and how quick it was between films, the gap between films.
I agree with that, because I do like if this movie is moved to December.
First of all, it gives you more time.
It gives you more time.
It gives you more time to work on your film, so you don't have to rush Howard to do what he needs to do. He can take some time. He can book out what he wants, block out what he wants the Star Wars film to be. Because he had none of that.
Yeah. And everything that's a big threat in December is going to move away because you're right there.
And your own studio would accommodate you by moving Mary Poppins up to November, which really would not change that box office fairly.
Well, see, here's the thing. Here's where this is a very Disney problem. Because you can't... So they can't move Mary Poppins to Thanksgiving. Why? Because they have two big release movies coming out in November. They have Wreck-It Ralph 2, and they have one that I don't think is going to be very good or all that popular, but it is very holiday-centric, which is the Nutcracker one. That one has to play around the holidays. You can't move that one. You're not going to move Wreck-It Ralph out of...
The first one was an October release, wasn't it?
Wreck-It Ralph?
Yeah.
It was like a March release, which you can't bump it back because you have...
cultural references already that you're going to be dated.
I don't think the cultural references are that dated, but you can't put it up against Captain Marvel. So, this year is the most interesting year for this to happen, because I do think any other year they would have kicked it down the road. They can't bump Solo to next year because you've got Episode 9 coming out. The way the calendar worked out, it did Solo no favor. So, like, of all of the Star Wars movies they made, this was the one that could not afford any of the things to go wrong for it to move to December, and everything went wrong, and it had to stick in that May date. And that's a very Disney problem, because Disney has things loaded throughout the calendar, and they're spacing it out from themselves. A lot of this is not just worried about other big releases from other people, because at this point, Disney has such a big gravity around it, everybody else is going to move away. But they still have to put out their movies, and they have to space them out accordingly. And with they're going to have three huge movies come out within November and December of this year. So Solo had to suck it up and stay in May. But I think if it could have moved, the same movie that we're just saying is just fine would have done a whole lot better business, because it would have been spaced out from Last Jedi. All the vitriol from there, I don't think it's going away, but it would have subsided because it's been a whole year and not just 5 months for them to fester and still kick at the hornet's nest.
Another tomatoes, right?
Yeah. And when you distance yourself from that, it doesn't matter how ill-conceived the movie is, because a lot of people don't think this movie should have happened. They would have been like, it's been a whole year, this is a Star Wars movie, I'm going to go see it. Most people that like Star Wars have been like, I enjoyed it, and they probably would have told people. They might not have seen it like 4 or 5 times, but they'll probably see it and tell somebody else that's going to go see it. This one, again, it's what? 4 weeks after Infinity War, a week after Deadpool, two or three weeks before Incredibles. Like, this is eh. Should I go see Solo? I mean, have you seen Infinity War? Yeah. Are you going to go see Incredibles? Yeah. Then you probably want to skip this one. So I do think it's the main culprit of what you said, the proximity to Last Jedi and suffering for the summer season. So I do think that because of this, I think we're gonna, you know, there was that talk of maybe having multiple Star Wars movies a year. I think that's done. There was talk of moving Star Wars away from December. I think that's done. December, Star Wars time. If you got a movie coming out in December, I know what you're going to say.
James Cameron would like to have a word with you, because he's going to put out all of his Avatar sequels in December for the next 5 years after 2019.
Well, he going to have to fight, because they ain't moving. And we're going to see. He better hope this next one does well, because I don't know if that's going to happen.
He said they'll be groundbreaking. Revolutionary.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
They're currently filming.
Yeah, they're currently... I know they're currently filming, but whatever. Forget that movies.
So, let's talk about this vitriolic fan base that likes to be upset. They have forced Kelly Marie Tan off of Instagram and all forms of social media. They did the same thing to Daisy Ridley shortly after... Force Awakens. John Boyega has pretty much just blown them the bird anytime that they've come at him. And I actually think that, you know, if the Star Wars thing doesn't work out, there is a place for him in a Pacific Rim franchise. Mm. That actually wasn't half bad. That movie was not half bad.
You're like the only person I've ever said that.
Yeah. So, you know, let's talk about this fan base, because it seems to be kind of upset right now. And taking it out on people who don't deserve it. Be kind to your actors, ladies and gentlemen.
I don't know Kelly Marie Tran, but she seems like a genuinely lovely person. Everything I've seen of her, she's been so ecstatic and over the top to be a part of this franchise. When at the premiere, she saw somebody cosplaying as Rose and went over there and gave her a hug, and she started crying because of what that meant to her. This is a person that's grown up with Star Wars, meaning a certain thing. She might not have been as into it, but she knows what Star Wars is. You want these fans say they want somebody to appreciate, they would want somebody in the movies that appreciates Star Wars. She's it. And you go after her and run her off. Why? Because to that set of Star Wars fans, they want the Star Wars they remember from when they were a kid. Which when I see them comment on stuff, they always want to say, you know, social justice warrior, which is loose, which translated means, you know, somebody fighting against the powers that be. Which I don't know what movies they've been watching, because the whole premise of Star Wars is you got rebels fighting against the powers that be, which are the Empire. The rebels you cheer for in the Star Wars movies are social justice warriors. The only difference is that in your mind, in the original trilogy, they're all dudes. They're all straight white dudes fighting against the Empire. But even then, you're blindly just going with that because there are three main characters in those movies. The third is the princess, who is more kick-ass than the other two when you first meet them put together. The definition you have in your head of a social justice warrior, that is what Leia is. You love her, but you hate every woman that's come after it. I don't understand why. What movie are you watching? Are you stuck being a 12-year-old prepubescent boy that could not talk to girls, and Star Wars was your only thing, and that you're so locked into that you can't accept any other view but the natural progression of what Star Wars was? It was the 70s. They wasn't putting a whole bunch of women forefront, but Leia was groundbreaking then. So what's the next logical progression? You're going to have women leads that are going to do the things that Leia's done. But you're going to hate them while still loving Leia, which makes no sense because they're the same goddamn person. What is wrong with y'all? Ran off Kelly Marie Tran, a lovely woman. Like, I wish I could apologize for you douchebags to her, because she doesn't deserve that. You ran off Daisy Ridley, who seeks equally, like, as invested in this role. I don't understand what you want, because if you get what you want, Star Wars is going to die. You just got a movie. Solo, as you just said, it's pretty much what you want. That's what you want. You douchebags were like, I ain't like The Last Jedi. I ain't gonna see that. And you see what happened? Solo was dying on the vine. You get what you want, your franchise starts to wither and die. What are you gonna do?
I can't agree more. Lucas made the films in an era that's post-Vietnam and influenced by the Vietnam War himself, and a hippie of that time himself. Like, Star Wars has always been inherently political. I mean, we can even go back 2 years to the fact that Rogue One comes out a month after the election of Donald Trump, and, like, becomes a very meaningful and powerful thing for those who were upset by that fact and who wanted to call themselves the Resistance and who, you know, wanted to, you know, felt like they had to be rebels and to, you know, they were scared about what was coming and what could be coming, and that movie was a source of hope for them. Like, there are all kinds of readings of all of the Star Wars movies that are highly political. But that's never changed over 40 years. I mean, literally the only thing about these things that have changed is the fact that we are no longer dealing with exclusively white leads.
Or male.
That seems to be the biggest problem. I mean, we remember when that first trailer comes out in November of 2014 at Thanksgiving, and John Boyega is the first thing you see. Mm-hmm. And, you know, fans freaking out. Black Stormtrooper? How can that be? They're all clones. You know, it just... that kind of rationale and thinking. Here's my deal, and I've had a lot of discussions with a number of people who don't like Last Jedi. I think the movie's fine. I really don't think that Ryan did anything that was overly crazy. I don't think he reimagined the character in any kind of way. The character is in any kind of harsh way. The fact that George himself has come out and said, yeah, I had the same idea about Luke. That Luke would be, you know, old and embittered and, you know, kind of like done with it all and just...
like every Jedi that we've seen before him. Obi-Wan, huddled up in a cave, with his little robes on, old and bitter.
Having fun with sand people.
Yeah. We go to Empire Strikes Back. Yoda, huddled up in the swamp, old and bitter, doesn't want anything to do with it. What did you think was going to happen? These are his mentors. What did they do? The going got tough? Let me find a hook.
Let me say this. I fundamentally believe that Luke Skywalker could have raised that X-Wing out of the water, got in it, and flown to Crait, battled Kylo Ren in a lightsaber fight for 3 minutes, held his green lightsaber, gone at it for three very intense minutes, like John Cena and The Undertaker. And then he could have held his green lightsaber up, meditated once he sensed that Rey and them had... Rey had gotten them, and that the resistance was safe, meditated. Kylo goes to take that cross-guard lightsaber, goes to go through him, and the robes just drop to the ground, just the same way they do on that rock on Octu, and he becomes a Force ghost, he talks to Rey, and Rey gets in the ship and goes, and that's your end of your movie. And I think that even if they had done, Ryan had written it that exact way, even giving everything else that's happened in the movie to that point, if he wrote it that exact way, they would still have issues. Because at the end of the day, for the majority of white males who are in their 40s and older, who grew up with Star Wars, they have an idea of who Luke Skywalker is in their head. And that idea was reinforced for 20 years by the expanded universe, which told stories of Luke going off-world and having adventures and chasing down parts of the Elder Tree and taking a wife and getting in lightsaber duels and building a new temple and training new Jedi and leading, you know, the galaxy in the ways of peace and justice. That's what they had in their head. And then the first line of the second trailer is... it's time for the Jedi to end. It's the last line of one of the two trailers.
The first one, yeah.
Yeah, and it's like, what? He doesn't want to be a Jedi. Like, no, that's not how it's supposed to be. He's supposed to be green lightsaber, go out, kill a bunch of people, like, fight to the death. Which, never mind the fact that, as T-Bob very eloquently put it a couple episodes ago, goes completely against the message of pacifism that is laced throughout the entire original trilogy. That's what they wanted. And they cannot in their minds comprehend that Disney looked at everything, that Rian Johnson looked at these characters and looked at their history and decided to make Luke an old, bitter man who never leaves the island.
This is... and you just brought it up. This is the curse of Star Wars. Star Wars, from the very beginning, has been a franchise that came out, there's a big gap. And the fans filled in what happened in the gap. They got a movie, and then, again, you had another gap. Fans filled in what you had in the gap. Most of those fans were young kids, so when they got their movies, they appreciated whatever they are. Now...
spent 3 years sitting around at Boy Scout meetings and around the lockers at school or in the clubs when they were in school, talking about, is he really his father? Or did Vader lie? Was that a lie? Is he really his father? And if he is his father, how did that happen? And why did Obi-Wan lie to him? And you have these kinds of questions in your mind that you discuss and you debate with friends for 3 years until you get the answers in Jedi.
Yep. And then after Jedi, there's this big long period where they don't think they're getting a movie. And then the extended universe comes in and it fills that gap.
Which Lucas allows. Because yep. Lucas never sues anybody. He leases out his characters. He lets new authors come in and do their thing and work with his characters. Yep. He never stops the EU. He emboldens it. Now, he emboldens it for financial reasons. Mm-hmm. But he emboldens it. He licenses it. So he had no problem with it.
Yep. But to them, this is what has happened. And then, you know, you get the prequels, and again, it doesn't affect what happens after Jedi, because you still have the extended universe. And then you get this big gap again. And then Disney buys it and said, we're going to do it. And guess what, guys? We're going to pretty much start where the logical step would be 30 years after Return of the Jedi. And this is where the problems come, because those people that are grown from kids, they're grown men, and they have this idea of what they think Star Wars should be because of the extended universe. Now, and I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that, but the extended universe is still there for you. These are different movies by different creators, and this is the way they want to go.
Well, that part of the problem there is the fact that one of Disney's first announcements was, it's Legends! It's yeah. Legends! There's a little bit of truth in every legend, but it is Legends, and we are not bound to it anymore.
Yeah, but that's their way of being able to make new cherry stories. Pick. Yeah, right. And you can cherry pick the stuff. It's all depending on what the creators want to do. And, I mean, I look at this a little different because, I mean, I grew up a comics guy, and every so often somebody would come along and retcon some stuff and, you know, and then make new lines and start different, take a character, start them from this point and go on.
Each author gets their own run.
Yeah, so I'm used to having things established and then something changing, or they're making another continuity with the same people, but they're not tied by the continuity from before, and it just goes. I'm used to these things. To me, when I watch comic book movies, all this is another timeline with the same character. So it's not beholden to what became before. It's a new story, so I can enjoy it, and I can still have the comics over here. A lot of people can't do that. And as I've talked to people, they just cannot do that, and it's to their detriment that they can't enjoy the thing that they love in a new iteration that they might be able to enjoy if they just give it a chance.
And honestly, I think some of the other part of this is something that JJ did. They never did, and they never will be able to again have all three of them together in the same place at the same time because of the way that you wrote Force Awakens. Mm-hmm. You never got the three of them together in the same place at the same time. And I think that was also heartbreaking for people who had Fisher, Hamill, and Ford are coming back for this new trilogy. And then you get what I imagine was essentially a three-act structure where a Han movie, a Luke movie, and a Leia movie. None of them together at any point. You get like 5 minutes, of 3 minutes of Luke and of Leia and Han in awkwardness in Force Awakens, and you don't get anything. You get, what, 30 seconds with Carrie Fisher and Mark Hamill on screen at the same time, and that's basically just a kiss goodbye?
Yeah.
And you never get Han and Luke on the screen at the same time. So, I mean, I think that's also an issue for them.
And I can understand that part, but I don't think that part covers the way they've just turned on everything.
I read a very good piece in the Hollywood Reporter today. These fans don't want to admit that they are like Luke. They're on their island and they don't want to leave their island, and you know, this is, you know, they screwed up. You know, I'm done with them. I can't do it anymore. You don't need to be a Jedi. The Jedi Order needs to die. I'm just going to stay on this island and do me, because I came here to die. And that's kind of who they are. I am not leaving this island. I am not getting off of this lawn. My Star Wars is this. Star Wars is only this, and you can't tell me any different.
That is a very good analogy. I really like that. The old fans of the Luke that they hate. Hmm? I think it's very fitting.
Indeed. So let's move past Star Wars, because we spent a good bit of time on it.
Yeah.
Chad, I know how much you loved Transformers The Last Knight.
Yes. Our definitions alike are very different, but okay.
Well, a year ago we sat in a theater with 30 other souls and we watched that movie.
It's been a year?
It's been a year.
Good God.
Yeah. So, we got a trailer this week for the Bumblebee movie starring John Cena.
Mm-hmm.
And Hailee Steinfeld.
Mm-hmm.
Your thoughts on the Bumblebee movie trailer?
So, with any Transformer movie, I'm going to be, there's going to be a slight trepidation with me because, you know, we've seen those other ones.
Trigger and, words.
Yeah. So, but my hope for this has always been that, especially after last night Bomb, that Michael Bay's finally moving out, and then you bring in the guy that did Kubo and the Two Strings, and that's a fantastic movie, and I have hope for this. So the biggest thing they have to do for me is
make him a Beatle.
Well, make him a Beatle's good, but I know you're not like straight up rebooting this, but this movie needs to be like a soft reboot. But that means you can't completely erase all the Michael Bay isms in one movie, but you start going down that road. And I hate to say this because I don't want to believe in a Transformers movie, but they're moving that way. Making Bumblebee a Beetle, making him smaller, getting rid of the gears and sprocket look of Michael Bay. Like, this is like a happy medium of what I would think of G1, like the original cartoon Bumblebee, and Michael Bay isms kind of put together, which leads me to believe that you go to the next, if there is a next movie, you can move further away from the Michael Bay isms. So clearly you can see that Bumblebee's like, I mean, he's a Beetle, so he's smaller. And he's not the big hulking thing that he was in the Michael Bay movies, but clearly his face is still a Michael Bay Bumblebee. There are nods to what he looks like in the G1. Again, we can move forward from that. So this trailer gives me hope that we are on the path to move away from it, and that Trevor Knight will make a good movie because he has good movie making sensibilities. Also, they stuck in Starscream, who looks like Starscream should look. Again, all these things make me want to have hope. But this movie was still made while Michael Bay had his hands deeply entrenched in the Transformers. So I don't know if the hooks are completely off in this movie. But I'm hopeful. I still don't want to say I want to see it. I want to see more before I want to say I'm going to see it.
I can get with that. I liked what I saw. Gave me hope.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, they have an opportunity here. It's an 80s set piece, so you don't have to acknowledge, you know, Chicago circa 2005. You don't have to acknowledge the wikis and, you know, the long dynasty history that we got in last night. We don't have to acknowledge Marky Mark. We don't have to acknowledge the glasses. We don't have to acknowledge, you know, secret societies or the Hoover Dam or any of that. We can just tell a story about a girl in her car, which at its heart was what the original movie should have been and was to an extent.
It's like the best parts of that movie. I generally like that movie better than all the rest, but that was the better parts. If this continues down that road, and I know we'll probably get a cameo of another Transformer at the end, I'm pretty sure we'll see what Optimus looks like. If he looks closer to the Optimus that I know and love and not that Firebird that just kills people recklessly like Michael Bay made, I mean, that alone will probably make me like this movie, and I will hate myself for it.
You're going to go see it.
I'm going to go see it, but I'm more willing to go see this one than the last night. You had to make me go see last night.
Indeed. So, Chad, we also got a Lego Movie 2 trailer. What are your thoughts on finally seeing a Lego Movie 2?
I mean, I thought it was okay. There's not a whole lot to it that I do. The big joke in it is about one of the biggest complaints when Lego Movie came out was, you know, the talented woman that really knows her stuff and knows how to do everything, and does everything gets pushed aside for the dumb guy who becomes the hero of the movie. And that's the big joke of this trailer. And I appreciate them having the wherewithal to do that. And I enjoyed that part. But overall, I wasn't in love with the trailer. And it makes me worried because Lego's on a trajectory of... It's on a downward trajectory.
After Lego Ninjago?
Even from Lego Movie to Lego Batman, which I think Lego Batman is the second best Lego movie, it's still a step down from the Lego movie. And Lego Ninjago is... somewhere down here. So it makes me wonder, it makes me concerned that Lego Movie was lightning in a bottle and that they've let the lightning out and now we are going to be stuck with nothing.
Well, part of the problem there is that kids age. And so by the time you can finally put out a sequel, those kids who were 5 are now 10 and may not relate to the movie, the material, the same way.
That's exactly... So I'm living that exact life because my kid was about 4 or 5 when the first one came out. She saw the trailer. She was still enthused about it. So I think you can still catch that age gap, those kids. But it would have been better if this movie came out like 2 years ago, say, of 4 or 5.
And they've had some issues, production delays and such. Director changes.
But I don't remember like loving the Lego trailers that much. So maybe it'll be the same thing. Like, I just go because... Well, no, I do think the last one got me because I went to see it without my kid at one point. But so maybe it'll be when we get another trailer, I'll be more excited about it. That's my hope. But I'm concerned about this franchise.
Is it a franchise? Should it be a franchise? Should the Roller Coaster Man reinvest?
That's the question. Is this a franchise or is this a one-off that got really lucky and now they're spitting it off and running it into the ground? I don't know. This movie will tell us if this should be a franchise or not.
All right, Chad. So, DC, Wonder Woman, out there filming. Your thoughts on Patty Jenkins actively working on a Wonder Woman 2?
My only thoughts about this filming are strictly selfish in my own because I happen to be in DC when Gal Gadot got into DC. And had I walked to a certain place instead of riding a bus, I may have actually run into Gal Gadot. So I am highly upset about that. But other than that, it's good to see that, you know, the successful DC property is
the only successful.
Yeah, is in swing making a movie, and we'll have some good news for us probably at Comic-Con, even though they'll only be shooting for like a month by the time that happens. But any motion on this movie is good news. And I'll say it here like I said on Twitter. I saw Gina Davis in Washington getting off the airplane. Only movie I know they're shooting in DC is Wonder Woman, so any day we want to drop that, I just want to say, y'all heard it from me before y'all heard it from everybody else.
Yeah, I'm interested. I think the Shazam stuff is also pretty interesting, what we've been saying. It's going to be a quiet Comic-Con. Like, we'll talk to Jim about this closer when we get closer, but this does not have the buzz or the feel of pretty much any Comic-Con that I can think of for the last maybe 5-6 years.
Well, that's the whole Marvel effect. They
said. Not necessarily. Marvel didn't show the Avengers, the con after Avengers, 2012. They've missed a couple of times, but there's always been something to take its place, a Disney panel or a DC panel or a Sony panel.
Well, did they do Star Wars the year they missed? Was that in between?
No, that was the same year. Okay. They had Marvel and Star Wars. Poor Kevin Hart nearly had a heart attack then when he, you know, had all the people leave him and go out for the
job. Oh, Kevin Smith, yeah. All before, it's like we had all these other studios and it's like, you know, we had hope that they could make good movies or potential for them to make good movies. That all the air is kind of being let out of everybody but Marvel. So when Marvel says, he ain't coming, and all you got left, you got Warner Brothers, but the past couple of times, Warner Brothers rolled out in the Comic-Con like, here, all the movies that we're going to have, none. We're going to do this again. Here, all the movies we're going to have, none. Not even like, no, they're still undeveloped. No, all the ones we've had, just blow up that screen that you saw. Less than a year later, we can't announce any of the same movies we just did. So, and this is Warner Brothers' track record right now. So, they're the ones holding the water for Comic-Con, and people don't have faith in them, so I'm not surprised that reactions are tempered until they can get their act together and show people faith and that there's another show besides Marvel in town.
Well, I mean, there's just not really much there. I mean, is Sony going to have a panel for Homecoming without Marvel? I mean, you know, what is 20th Century Fox going to bring? Because, you know, they're going to bring Dark Phoenix? Are they going to put the cast and crew for that out there? I mean, the vote on the sale is a week or two before Comic-Con. You know, So what are they going to bring? You know, what is Warner's going to bring as far as a full presentation, not just DC? What else are they going to bring?
Yeah.
The only thing that I'm looking forward to, honestly, is Lionsgate, because not Lionsgate. You know, yeah. I think it's no, it's not Lionsgate. I'm looking forward to the Godzilla stuff because the Godzilla franchise has actually been really good. Like, we got a very good, at least a good Godzilla movie that is closer to what Godzilla movie should be from Gary. We got a good Kong movie from Jordan Rogers, which made money. Both those movies made money. Not Marvel money, but they made money. And now we're going to get a Godzilla 2 from the guy who did Krampus and Trick or Treat. And the cast looks awesome, and it's got, you know, 11 in it, and it's got Kyle Chandler
right,
in it.
Yeah.
And they're doing Destroy All Monsters. They're doing Rodan and Mothra and Godzilla and the whole thing. And then after he gets done defeating those three monsters, the three most epic monsters in his entire catalog, that, you know, Toho was so pleased with the way that the first movie was like, here, we'll lease these to you. You can play with these. Wouldn't let Roland play with these.
No.
But you can play with these. After he gets done fighting those three, he then has to go fight Kong.
Yeah.
And then him and Kong have to team up to defeat something else more than likely, because you can't just have the movie be a fight between Kong and Godzilla, because in all reality, even as big as they've made Kong, Godzilla can breathe atomic fire.
Yeah.
He ripped a Kotu's head off and spit atomic fire down its throat. If he breathes atomic fire on Kong, Kong's done. So, not to mention the fact that he still only comes up to, like, Godzilla's waist.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
they gotta downside Godzilla a little bit.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's what I'm looking forward to the most from Comic-Con, is any kind of Godzilla presentation. I think they did a small Godzilla 2 presentation at Comic-Con last year.
I think they gotta up it this time.
But we gotta up it, because we gotta get excited for that, and we've also gotta get some teases in for Kong versus Godzilla, and, you know, what cast members might be coming into that, and, you know, Gareth's not coming back to direct it. I think they just recently lined up a director for it, actually. But, you know, if we're gonna get up to 2020, we're 2 years out, we need to start having conversations about this, because this is, outside of the MCU, this is the most coherent cinematic universe that's out there.
Two movies and the most coherent. Warner Brothers. I honestly forgot about
Well, it is Warner Brothers. I think it's a Warner Brothers production.
Which is the frustrating part. Because they can pick and choose what they get right. But the stuff I like, DC, we can't just do it. We just can't do it.
Roller Coaster Man likes his Japanese monsters.
Whatever, man.
Alright, Chad. So, I've been in Vegas. I bet $500 on the Stanford Cardinal to win the national championship in college football.
I said he shouldn't do that, but apparently all the odds were against me, so he did it.
And then, the odds are ever in my favor. And then I was in Georgia. You were in D.C.,
mm-hmm.
So that accounts for our missing 3 weeks
of
podcasts. But we're not going to go that far along anymore, at least for the rest foreseeable future. We are going to have Jim on. Jim's been busy promoting his play and Skin Jobs, which was a brilliant play about whitewashing in the industry. I tried to retweet that and promote that as much as I could, because Jim is a friend of the podcast and we like to support him in things that he does. But he's going to be on with us closer to Comic-Con. Obviously at IGN right now, he's just coming off the play, and then they're also busy having meetings and things for their live stream that they always do every year. And
that's right.
And it's a huge, the Comic-Con San Diego is a huge
deal for everybody. Yeah.
A huge deal for everybody, especially coming off of E3 and rolling right into SDCC.
Yeah, that's right.
So,
yeah.
So they're busy, and so he's graciously decided to give us some time closer to San Diego Comic-Con, so we can preview that as we do every year.
Mm.
We have Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom, otherwise known as the movie that introduces cloning of human beings, spoiler alert, to the world. And don't go in expecting a lot of Jeff Goldblum. That comes out. I'm seeing Incredibles double feature. Chad's going to see the movie with his daughter, so we'll be able to talk about Incredibles the next time we get together. We'll probably... I am boycotting, to an extent, on Lost World, on Fallen Kingdom after what I've read today. Chad's probably going to go and see it because his daughter loves dinosaurs.
Yep, that's what happens.
I will probably relent because I'm a nerd and I can't stay out of a movie theater. So we'll be able to talk about that at some point. And then we get to do a whole podcast on Ant-Man and the Wasp, because we have another Marvel movie coming out before the end of the year.
Yep, I think this will be my daughter's second favorite Marvel movie, which is Ant-Man. So, yeah, she'll be seeing that. I'll be seeing this one a couple of times.
So that'll be the month. And, you know, it's going to be fun, and it's going to be exciting. Get on board, and leave your sexism and chauvinism at the door. As we go through this. So, for Chad, I am Brian. I am at BCW Tiger Fan.
At the Mets Theory.
Thank you very much, and have a pleasant evening.